from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where fascinating political events have been unfolding for the last couple of days. Donald Trump had a masterful win, maybe the most impressive in American political history, sweeping five states in the East, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Maryland, Rhode Island, and Delaware, and taking 111 of the 118 candidates, delegates that were available. Just to illustrate the enormity of the win, Pennsylvania has 80 counties, which constitute 80 different elections. Trump won every single one of those 80 different counties. I mean, this was enormous. This was most impressive. And it, in my opinion, cements his lock on the Republican nomination. He gave a foreign policy address today at the National Press Club, which I regarded as brilliant that I wanted to share it with you because I think it's an historic moment in the unfolding evolution of his campaign, where what is most important to notice is the extent to which what Trump was outlining here.
Thank you to the Center for National Interest for honoring me with this invitation. It truly is a great honor. I'd like to talk today about how to develop a new foreign policy direction for our country, one that replaces randomness with purpose, ideology with strategy, and chaos with peace. It's time to shake the rust off America's foreign policy. It's time to invite new voices and new visions into the fold, something we have to do. The direction I will outline today will also return us to a timeless principle. My foreign policy will always put the interests of the American people and American security above all else. Has to be first. Has to be. That will be the foundation of every single decision that I will make. America, thank you. America First will be the major and overriding theme of my administration. But to chart our path forward, we must first briefly take a look back. We have a lot to be proud of. In the 1940s, we saved the world. The greatest generation beat back the Nazis and Japanese imperialists. Then we saved the world again, this time from totalitarianism and communism. The Cold War, it lasted for decades, but guess what? We won, and we won big. Democrats and Republicans working together got Mr. Gorbachev to heed the words of President Reagan, our great president, when he said, "Tear down this wall." History will not forget what he did. Very special, special man and president. Unfortunately, after the Cold War, our foreign policy veered badly, of course. We failed to develop a new vision for a new time. In fact, as time went on, our foreign policy began to make less and less sense. Logic was replaced with foolishness and arrogance, which led to one foreign policy disaster after another. They just kept coming and coming. We went from mistakes in Iraq to Egypt to Libya to President Obama's line in the sand in Syria. Each of these actions have helped to throw the region into chaos and gave ISIS the space it needs to grow and prosper. Very bad. It all began with a dangerous idea that we could make Western democracies out of countries that had no experience or interest in becoming a Western democracy. We tore up what institutions they had and then were surprised at what we unleashed. Civil war, religious fanaticism, thousands of Americans and just killed lives wasted, horribly wasted. Many trillions of dollars were lost as a result. The vacuum was created that ISIS would fill. Iran, too, would rush in and fill that void, much to their really unjust enrichment. They have benefited so much, so sadly for us. Our foreign policy is a complete and total disaster. No vision, no purpose, no direction, no strategy. Today, I want to identify five main weaknesses in our foreign policy. First, our resources are totally overextended. President Obama has weakened our military by weakening our economy. He's crippled us with wasteful spending, massive debt, low growth, a huge trade deficit, and open borders. Our manufacturing trade deficit with the world is now approaching $1 trillion a year. We're rebuilding other countries while weakening our own. Ending the theft of American jobs will give us resources we need to rebuild our military, which has to happen, and regain our financial independence and strength. I am the only person running for the presidency who understands this, and this is a serious problem. I'm the only one, believe me, I know them all. I'm the only one that knows how to fix it. Secondly, our allies are not paying their fair share, and I've been talking about this recently a lot. Our allies must contribute toward their financial, political, and human costs, have to do it, of our tremendous security burden. But many of them are simply not doing so. They look at the United States as weak and forgiving and feel no obligation to honor their agreements with us. In NATO, for instance, only 4 of 28 other member countries besides America are spending the minimum required 2% of GDP on defense. We have spent trillions of dollars over time on planes, missiles, ships, equipment, building up our military to provide a strong defense for Europe and Asia. The countries we are defending must pay for the cost of this defense. And if not, the U.S. must be prepared to let these countries defend themselves. We have no choice. The whole world will be safer if our allies do their part to support our common defense and security. A Trump administration will lead a free world that is properly armed and funded beautifully. Thirdly, our friends are beginning to think they can't depend on us. We've had a president who dislikes our friends and bows to our enemies, something that we've never seen before in the history of our country. He negotiated a disastrous deal with Iran, and then we watched them ignore its terms even before the ink was dry. Iran cannot be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. Cannot be allowed. Remember that. Cannot be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. And under a Trump administration, we'll never, ever be allowed to have that nuclear weapon. All of this without even mentioning the humiliation of the United States with Iran's treatment of our 10 captured sailors. So vividly I remember that day. In negotiation, you must be willing to walk. The Iran deal, like so many of our worst agreements, is the result of not being willing to leave the table. When the other side knows you're not going to walk, it becomes absolutely impossible to win. You just can't win. At the same time, your friends need to know that you will stick by the agreements that you have with them. You've made that agreement. You have to stand by it, and the world will be a better place. President Obama gutted our missile defense program, then abandoned our missile defense plans with Poland and the Czech Republic. He supported the ouster of a friendly regime in Egypt that had a long-standing peace treaty with Israel and then helped bring the Muslim Brotherhood to power in its place. Israel, our great friend, and the one true democracy in the Middle East, has been snubbed and criticized by an administration that lacks moral clarity. Just a few days ago, Vice President Biden again criticized Israel, a force for justice and peace, for acting as an impatient peace area in the region. President Obama has not been a friend to Israel. He's treated Iran with tender love and care and made it a great power. Iran has indeed become a great, great power in just a very short period of time because of what we've done. All of the expense and all at the expense of Israel, our allies in the region, and very importantly, the United States itself. We picked fights with our oldest friends, and now they're starting to look elsewhere for help. Remember that. Not good. Fourth, our rivals no longer respect us. In fact, they're just as confused as our allies. But an even bigger problem is that they don't take us seriously anymore. Truth is, they don't respect us. When President Obama landed in Cuba on Air Force One, no leader was there, nobody, to greet him. Perhaps an incident without precedent in the long and prestigious history of Air Force One. Then amazingly, the same thing happened in Saudi Arabia. It's called no respect, absolutely no respect. Do you remember when the president made a long and expensive trip to Copenhagen, Denmark, to get the Olympics for our country? And after this unprecedented effort, it was announced that the United States came in fourth. Fourth place. The President of the United States making this trip, unprecedented, comes in fourth place. He should have known the result before making such an embarrassing commitment. We were laughed at all over the world, as we have been many, many times. The list of humiliations go on and on and on. President Obama watches helplessly as North Korea increases its aggression and expands further and further with its nuclear reach. Our president has allowed China to continue its economic assault on American jobs and wealth, refusing to enforce trade deals and apply leverage on China necessarily to rein in North Korea. We have the leverage, we have the power over China, economic power, and people don't understand it. And with that economic power, we can rein in and we can get them to do what they have to do with North Korea, which is totally out of control. He has even allowed China to steal government secrets with cyber attacks and engage in industrial espionage against the United States and its companies. We've let our rivals and challengers think they can get away with anything. And they do. They do. At will, it always happens. If President Obama's goal had been to weaken America, he could not have done a better job. Finally, America no longer has a clear understanding of our foreign policy goals. Since the end of the Cold War and the breakup of the Soviet Union, we've lacked a coherent foreign policy. One day we're bombing Libya and getting rid of a dictator to foster democracy for civilians. The next day we're watching the same civilians suffer while that country falls and absolutely falls apart. Lives lost, massive monies lost, the world is a different place. We're a humanitarian nation, but the legacy of the Obama-Clinton interventions will be weakness, confusion, and disarray. A mess. We've made the Middle East more unstable and chaotic than ever before. We left Christians subject to intense persecution and even genocide. We have done nothing to help the Christians, nothing. And we should always be ashamed for that lack of action, Our actions in Iraq, Libya, and Syria have helped unleash ISIS. And we're in a war against radical Islam, but President Obama won't even name the enemy. And unless you name the enemy, you will never, ever solve the problem. Hillary Clinton also refuses to say the words radical Islam, even as she pushes for a massive increase in refugees coming into our country. After Secretary Clinton's failed intervention in Libya, Islamic terrorists in Benghazi took down our consulate and killed our ambassador and three brave Americans. Then, instead of taking charge that night, Hillary Clinton decided to go home and sleep. Incredible. Clinton blames it all on a video, an excuse that was a total lie, proven to be absolutely a total lie. Our ambassador was murdered, and our Secretary of State misled the nation. And by the way, she was not awake to take that call at 3 o'clock in the morning. And now ISIS is making millions and millions of dollars a week selling Libya oil. And you know what? We don't blockade. We don't bomb. We don't do anything about it. It's almost as if our country doesn't even know what's happening, which could be a fact and could be true. This will all change when I become president. To our friends and allies, I say America is going to be strong again. America is going to be reliable again. It's going to be a great and reliable ally again. It's going to be a friend again. We're going to finally have a coherent foreign policy based upon American interests and the shared interests of our allies. We're getting out of the nation-building business and instead focusing on creating stability in the world. Our moments of greatest strength came when politics ended at the water's edge. We need a new, rational American foreign policy, informed by the best minds and supported by both parties, and it will be by both parties, Democrats, Republicans, independence, everybody, as well as by our close allies. This is how we won the Cold War, and it's how we will win our new future struggles, which may be many, which may be complex, but we will win if I become president. First, we need a long-term plan to halt the spread and reach of radical Islam. Containing the spread of radical Islam must be a major foreign policy goal of the United States and indeed the world. Events may require the use of military force, but it's also a philosophical struggle, like our long struggle in the Cold War. In this, we're going to be working very closely with our allies in the Muslim world, all of which are at risk from radical Islamic violence, attacks, and everything else. It is a dangerous world, more dangerous now than it has ever been. We should work, thank you. We should work together with any nation in the region that is threatened by the rise of radical Islam. But this has to be a two-way street. They must also be good to us. Remember that. They have to be good to us. No longer one way. It's now two way. And remember us and all we are doing. They have to appreciate what we've done to them. We're going to help, but they have to appreciate what we've done for them. The struggle against radical Islam also takes place in our homeland. There are scores of recent migrants inside our borders charged with terrorism. For every case known to the public, there are dozens and dozens more. We must stop importing extremism through senseless immigration policies, We have no idea where these people are coming from. There's no documentation. There's no paperwork. There's nothing. We have to be smart. We have to be vigilant. A pause for reassessment will help us to prevent the next San Bernardino, or, frankly, much worse. All you have to do is look at the World Trade Center and September 11th, one of the great catastrophes, in my opinion, the single greatest military catastrophe in the history of our country, worse than Pearl Harbor, because Italia, because you take a look at what's happened, and citizens were attacked as opposed to the military being attacked, one of the true great catastrophes. And then there's ISIS. I have a simple message for them. Their days are numbered. I won't tell them where, and I won't tell them how. We must, as a nation, be more unpredictable. We are totally predictable. We tell everything. We're sending troops, we tell them. We're sending something else, we have a news conference. We have to be unpredictable. And we have to be unpredictable starting now. But they're going to be gone. ISIS will be gone if I'm elected president. And they'll be gone quickly. They will be gone very, very quickly. Secondly, we have to rebuild our military and our economy. The Russians and Chinese have rapidly expanded their military capability, but look at what's happened to us. Our nuclear weapons arsenal, our ultimate deterrent, has been allowed to atrophy and is desperately in need of modernization and renewal, and it has to happen immediately. Our active duty armed forces have shrunk from 2 million in 1991 to about 1.3 million today. The Navy has shrunk from over 500 ships to 272 ships during this same period of time. The Air Force is about one-third smaller than 1991. Pilots flying B-52s in combat missions today, these planes are older than virtually everybody in this room. And what are we doing about this? President Obama has proposed a 2017 defense budget that in real dollars cuts nearly 25% from what we were spending in 2011. Our military is depleted, and we're asking our generals and military leaders to worry about global warming. We will spend what we need to rebuild our military. It is the cheapest single investment we can make. We will develop, build, and purchase the best equipment known to mankind. Our military dominance must be unquestioned, and I mean unquestioned by anybody and everybody. But we will look for savings and spend our money wisely. In this time of mounting debt, right now we have so much debt that nobody even knows how to address the problem, but I do. No $1 can be wasted. Not one single dollar can we waste. We're also going to have to change our trade, immigration, and economic policies to make our economy strong again and to put Americans first again. This will ensure that our own workers, right here in America, get the jobs and higher pay that will grow our tax revenues, increase our economic might as a nation, make us strong financially again. So, so important. We need to think smarter about areas where our technological superiority, and nobody comes close, gives us an edge. This includes 3D printing, artificial intelligence, and cyber warfare. A great country also takes care of its warriors. Our commitment to them is absolute, and I mean absolute. a Trump administration will give our servicemen and women the best equipment and support in the world when they serve and where they serve, and the best care in the world when they return as veterans and they come back home to civilian life. Our veterans have not been treated fairly or justly. These are our great people, and we must treat them fairly. And we must even treat them really, really well. And that will happen under the Trump administration. Finally, we must develop a foreign policy based on American interests. Businesses do not succeed when they lose sight of their core interests, and neither do countries. Look at what happened in the 1990s. Our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and this was a horrible period of time for us, were attacked, and 17 brave sailors were killed on the USS Cole. And what did we do? It seemed we put more effort into adding China into the World Trade Organization, which has been a total disaster for the United States. Frankly, we spent more time on that than we did in stopping Al-Qaeda. We even had an opportunity to take out Osama bin Laden, and we didn't do it. And then we got hit at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, again, the worst attack on our country in its history. Our foreign policy goals must be based on America's core national security interests. And the following will be my priorities. In the Middle East, our goals must be, and I mean must be, to defeat terrorists and promote regional stability, not radical change. We need to be clear-sighted about the groups that will never be anything other than enemies. And believe me, we have groups that no matter what you do, they will be the enemy. We have to be smart enough to recognize who those groups are, who those people are, and not help them. And we must only be generous to those that prove they are indeed our friends. We desire to live peacefully and in friendship with Russia and China. We have serious differences with these two nations and must regard them with open eyes. But we are not bound to be adversaries. We should seek common ground based on shared interests. Russia, for instance, has also seen the horror of Islamic terrorism. I believe an easing of tensions and improved relations with Russia from a position of strength only is possible, absolutely possible. Common sense says this cycle, this horrible cycle of hostility, must end and ideally will end soon. Good for both countries. Some say the Russians won't be reasonable. I intend to find out. If we can't make a deal under my administration, a deal that's great, not good, great for America, but also good for Russia, then we will quickly walk from the table. It's as simple as that. We're going to find out. Fixing our relations with China is another important step in really toward creating a even more prosperous period of time. China respects strength. And by letting them take advantage of us economically, which they are doing like never before, we have lost all of their respect. We have a massive trade deficit with China, a deficit that we have to find a way quickly, and I mean quickly, to balance. A strong and smart America is an America that will find a better friend in China, better than we have right now. Look at what China is doing in the South China Sea. They're not supposed to be doing it. No respect for this country or this president. We can both benefit or we can both go our separate ways. If need be, that's what's going to have to happen. After I'm elected president, I will also call for a summit with our NATO allies and a separate summit with our Asian allies. In these summits, we will not only discuss a rebalancing of financial commitments, but take a fresh look at how we can adopt new strategies for tackling our common challenges. For instance, we will discuss how we can upgrade NATO's outdated mission and structure grown out of the Cold War to confront our shared challenges, including migration and Islamic terrorism. I will not hesitate to deploy military force when there is no alternative. But if America fights, it must only fight to win. I will never send our finest into battle unless necessary, and I mean absolutely necessary, and will only do so if we have a plan for victory with a capital V. Our goal is peace and prosperity, not war and destruction. The best way to achieve those goals is through a disciplined, deliberate, and consistent foreign policy. With President Obama and Secretary Clinton, we've had the exact opposite, a reckless, rudderless, and aimless foreign policy, one that has blazed a path of destruction in its wake. After losing thousands of lives and spending trillions of dollars, we are in far worse shape in the Middle East than ever before. I challenge anyone to explain the strategic foreign policy vision of Obama Clinton. It has been a complete and total disaster. I will also be prepared to deploy America's economic resources. Financial leverage and sanctions can be very, very persuasive, but we need to use them selectively and with total determination. Our power will be used if others do not play by the rules. In other words, if they do not treat us fairly. Our friends and enemies must know that if I draw a line in the sand, I will enforce that line in the sand. Believe me. However, unlike other candidates for the presidency, war and aggression will not be my first instinct. You cannot have a foreign policy without diplomacy. A superpower understands that caution and restraint are really, truly signs of strength. Although not in government service, I was totally against the war in Iraq, very proudly, saying for many years that it would destabilize the Middle East. Sadly, I was correct. And the biggest beneficiary has been Iran, who is systematically taking over Iraq and gaining access to their very, very rich oil reserves, something it has wanted to do for decades. And now, to top it off, we have ISIS. My goal is to establish a foreign policy that will endure for several generations. That's why I also look and have to look for talented experts with approaches and practical ideas, rather than surrounding myself with those who have perfect resumes but very little to brag about, except responsibility for a long history of failed policies and continued losses at war. We have to look to new people. We have to look to new people because many of the old people, frankly, don't know what they're doing, even though they may look awfully good writing in the New York Times or being watched on television. Finally, I will work with our allies to reinvigorate Western values and institutions. Instead of trying to spread universal values that not everybody shares or wants, we should understand that strengthening and promoting Western civilization and its accomplishments will do more to inspire positive reforms around the world than military interventions. These are my goals as president. I will seek a foreign policy that all Americans, whatever their party, can support, so important, and which our friends and allies will respect and totally welcome. The world must know that we do not go abroad in search of enemies, that we are always happy when old enemies become friends and when old friends become allies. That's what we want. We want them to be our allies. We want the world to be our, we want to bring peace to the world. Too much destruction out there. Too many destructive weapons. The power of weaponry is the single biggest problem that we have today in the world. To achieve these goals, Americans must have confidence in their country and its leadership again. Many Americans must wonder why our politicians seem more interested in defending the borders of foreign countries than in defending their own. Americans must know that we're putting the American people first again. On trade. So true. On trade. On immigration. On foreign policy. The jobs, incomes, and security of the American worker will always be my first priority. No country has ever prospered that failed to put its own interests first. Both our friends and our enemies put their countries above ours. And we, while being fair to them, must start doing the same. We will no longer surrender this country or its people to the false song of globalism. The nation state remains the true foundation for happiness and harmony. I am skeptical of international unions that tie us up and bring America down and will never enter. And under my administration, we will never enter America into any agreement that reduces our ability to control our own affairs. NAFTA, as an example, has been a total disaster for the United States and has emptied our states, literally emptied our states of our manufacturing and our jobs. And I've just gotten to see it. I've toured Pennsylvania. I've toured New York. I've toured so many of the states. They have been cleaned out. Their manufacturing is gone. Never again. Only the verse. And I have to say this strongly. Never again. Only the reverse will happen. We will keep our jobs and bring in new ones. There will be consequences for the companies that leave the United States only to exploit it later. They fire the people. They take advantage of the United States. There will be consequences for those companies. Never again. Under a Trump administration, no American citizen will ever again feel that their needs come second to the citizens of a foreign country. I will view, as president, the world through the clear lens of American interests. I will be America's greatest defender and most loyal champion. We will not apologize for becoming successful again, but will instead embrace the unique heritage that makes us who we are. The world is most peaceful and most prosperous when America is strongest. America will continue and continue forever to play the role of peacemaker. We will always help save lives and indeed humanity itself. But to play that role, we must make America strong again. And always, 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 we must make, and we have to look at it from every angle, and we have no choice. We must make America respected again. We must make America truly wealthy again. And we will make America great again. And if we do that, perhaps this century can be the most peaceful and prosperous the world has ever, ever known. Thank you very much, everybody. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Now, those who have watched Donald give that speech earlier today, of course, are getting a second bite at the apple. Frankly, I think it was quite brilliant. The one area where I would take exception was his attack on the Iran nuclear deal, which, of course, was ill-founded insofar as our own intelligence agencies, all 16, had concluded that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons in 2007, which they reaffirmed in 2011. Even the Mossad concluded Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons in 2012, 3 weeks before Bibi Netanyahu went to the United Nations and affirmed precisely the opposite. But that means it'll be very easy for his administration to guarantee that Iran will not develop nuclear weapons during his administration, since Iran is not developing nuclear weapons at all. I believe he'll be brought up to speed about that, and I already see a diminution in his rhetorical emphasis on Iran. But what he had to say about free trade, which has been a backbone of Republican orthodoxy, and the endless wars in the Middle East, which, of course, were a legacy from the Bush-Cheney administration, were actually rather stunning developments. In other words, here you have the leading Republican candidate giving a foreign policy speech that basically repudiates the tenets of foreign policy that have dominated the party of which he is the leading candidate. And frankly, at this point in time, I can see no way in which Donald Trump can be denied the Republican nomination. Now, it's rather fascinating as to the response by Ted Cruz, who conned John Kasich into not devoting resources in Indiana, which he, Cruz, then described as John Kasich having pulled out of Indiana, which is another manifestation of what Trump is talking about when he refers to him as lying Ted. Kasich didn't pull out. Kasich simply agreed that he would emphasize other states while Cruz sought to beat Trump in Indiana. But I believe that the agreement, their collusion, as Donald refers to it, has had a very negative effect, weakened them both, and probably was tremendously beneficial even in putting frosting on the cake in the five states in the Far East, which he won so handily. Indeed, I wonder whether there's ever been such a significant political victory by any candidate in recent American history. Frankly, I doubt it. So what has Cruz's response been? Well, he held a press conference of his own after Donald had finished speaking and introduced his vice presidential running mate, which was an incredible act of presumption, since Cruz has not only not secured the nomination, but there's not even any way mathematically he could possibly do so prior to the convention, where he selected Carly Fiorina to be his running mate. where Carly's a dubious prospect on several grounds, but I just mentioned, most importantly, that he gave away his negotiating ability with other candidates like Marco Rubio and John Kasich, who actually have delegates. In other words, by having the vice presidential slot available, Cruz would have been able to negotiate with them for them to run as his running mate if they would share their delegate totals with Cruz, which would
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there.
Claims to be the candidate.
Biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information.
Who's been identified by a national tabloid, The Inquirer, as having affairs with at least five different women, one of whom is a hooker, and where some of these trysts are supposed to have taken place in closets and bathrooms. That's sordid enough. But there's a great deal of corroborating evidence. For example, it has been discovered that his Senate office was a subscriber to the Ashley Madison newsletter for adulterers. I mean, it has, you know, millions of subscribers, but that one of them should be Ted Cruz, who holds himself as a paragon of moral virtue, is really quite stunning. In addition, we had a reporter, columnist for the Washington Times by the name of Drew Johnson, who confirmed at least two of the mistresses identified by the National Enquirer were correct, for which he was promptly fired. Now, that's very troubling on multiple grounds because it implies that the media are covering this up, and it's clear they are because, in fact, the story had been shopped around to the New York Times, to the Washington Post, to CBS, NBC, ABC, and so forth, before the National Enquirer picked it up. And in addition, although Cruz claimed it had come from the Trump campaign, they had nothing to do with it. And indeed, the best I can determine, it actually came from Mario Rubio's people to tarnish Trump. But because so many are not paying attention, I believe this will get much more emphasis, perhaps even now in the next few days before the Indiana contest actually takes place. We also have the D.C. Madam's attorney at law, who has requested to be relieved of a suppression order by the courts that have directed him not to release information from her black book about who were her clients, where he has observed to the court that this involves information of great importance to the national security, in particular to the political competition taking place, where it's important that voters have this information before they head for the polls. What's been suppressed so long now, it's not going to have other than historical significance in retrospect, I suspect. But where during a conversation I had with Jeff Rentz about this issue, perhaps as long as 3 weeks ago, Jeff told me they already had the information and that indeed it was Ted Cruz. And he sent me a copy of the part of the D.C. Madam's little black book that identified Ted Cruz. So the man is a hypocrite's hypocrite. If there's ever been a more monstrous fraud, a deceiver who speaks with great passion, who seems to have a messianic fervor and conviction about himself, it has to be Ted Cruz. A most interesting conversation I had with Jim Condit Jr., by the way, who's running for the congressional seat formerly held by the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, in Connecticut, where Condit explained to me that both the win by Cruz in Texas was manipulated by voting machines, that he's not popular in Texas, and that everyone in Texas was talking about Donald Trump, and that the same is true for John Kasich's victory in Ohio, when both instances the Republican Party and the Stop Trump people used the fact that they were it was their home state to give the candidates their states on a silver platter. And as most of you will have heard me explain, what happened here in Wisconsin was completely contrived, where Trump was leading by 10 points a week before the Marquette School of Law released its poll showing that now Trump was lagging behind Cruz by 10 points, a 20-point shift that simply doesn't happen, and where the best poll results we had coming from istandwith.com show that in all eight districts in Wisconsin, Trump had a significant margin over Cruz right up to the election. By in District 1, for example, 63-37, District 2, 62-36, and so forth, where the lowest advantage was in one where he was only 53-47. But the point is that Trump was prevailing in all eight districts, and where I consulted with a brilliant statistician who's published two books about the theft of elections using electronic voting machines, namely Richard Charnin, who confirmed that the election had been stolen here in Wisconsin, so that the three major roadblocks that have been set up to defeat Trump, Cruz winning Texas, Kasich winning Ohio, and Cruz again eking out a victory here in Wisconsin, were all managed behind the scenes by electronic voting machines. In fact, Jim Condit Jr. has an open letter to Donald Trump out there on his website. I encourage everyone to read, because he's terribly concerned that the use of these voting machines is going to continue to be used to the disadvantage of Donald Trump. And I would not be surprised, but the fact is that now at this point in time, Trump is winning by such enormous margins that it's very implausible to foresee him losing. He's already ahead by some 20 points in California, which is the big enchilada that most certainly is going to put him over the top. And where I'd say now the estimates that Trump might have as many as 1,400 delegates before the Cleveland convention looks to me to be spot on, that he will be the Republican nominee, that he will have it sewn up before the convention, I think is no longer in doubt, bar for some extremist action where I've been profoundly troubled that even individuals of the prominence of Mark Zuckerberg, who owns Facebook, has put up web pages soliciting the assassination of Donald Trump. Why the Secret Service hasn't been all over this, I cannot imagine, because it seems to me a gross dereliction of duty. And if anything should happen to Trump, I think, you know, it's going to be catastrophic for the country. He's done more to reveal the shenanigans, to bring home the point that our elections are all rigged, that the respective parties manage them, but do so in different ways, where the Democrats, for example, create a vast number of super delegates so that they can guarantee who's going to be the winner. And where Bernie has been subverted in his efforts, just as has Trump, and where there's state after state after state where the exit polls showed that Bernie Sanders had actually won the state, including Illinois and Nebraska, as I recall, if I can find my list, that it's shocking to realize how much we do not live in a democracy. We live in the pretense of a democracy. We live in a fake society. Just as Paul Craig Roberts recently wrote, do Americans live in a false reality of constructed events? Where he was talking about my research on Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing, which of course has been collaborative with 13 contributors, including six PhD, current or retired college professors to the Sandy Hook book, and another six to the Boston bombing book, including even essays by John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute and by Paul Craig Roberts himself. So we have to become aware, and we're not going to learn about these matters from the mass media, who are totally corrupt and under the control of the government, sad to say. Now, the second half is going to be the new JFK show, where Larry Rivera has some fascinating report to make about a very prominent member of the JFK research community. So I encourage everyone to stand by for what I think they will discover to be a rather stunning set of reports about this prominent figure with whom you are all familiar. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Stand by for part two.
We can now say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the new JFK show, number 100. Can you believe we've hit the century mark? We've been really working hard at bringing the truth. We're trying to bring the cutting edge things to us. Now, I'd like to bring to the attention that there is an article coming up in the National Enquirer magazine, which oddly enough has more credibility than the mainstream ones. It's they're going to have an article about
Raphael. Gary, did we lose you? Yeah, I agree. That on certain issues that the National Enquirer is doing the job and the mainstream media is not. Are we there, Chance? Are we online?
Yeah, we're rolling. Can y'all hear me? Okay. All right. So anyway, we're having it championed that the OIC is going to be featured in the National Enquirer. However, Larry is our guy who is really all about the evidence. So I feel we have to step carefully. There is a picture on Elm Street along with a lot of other people. And some people are saying it's Rafael Cruz. And as far as I know, I can't be convinced about it. I know Larry's looked into it. So we're going to talk about that. And also Robert Grodin. So we're going to bring Robert Grodin to the forefront. We've talked about him many times, and we're just completely exposing Grodin for who he is. And so, Larry, can you tell us about this new thing about the article in the National Enquirer?
Yeah, good evening. Welcome to the new JFK show, to everybody that tunes in on a weekly basis here. The truth, you know, and the alternative information that you don't see anywhere else, led by Professor James Fetzer. And we've lost him momentarily here, but the National Enquirer just published the Wayne Madsen information that we had presented in the previous show, which showed an individual matching the physical characteristics of Cruz's father at the trademark, handing out leaflets with the Lee Oswald down at the trademark in the summer of 1963, and that issue of the National Enquirer has already hit the supermarkets, and the next issue is supposed to that is supposed to be published has to do with the Cisco photograph, which shows the JFK limousine on Main Street before it reaches the Houston intersection, the Houston Street intersection, and it is a picture, the photograph that's very familiar to researchers because it's in color, and it shows the limo from an overhead angle where you can see inside of the limousine and the occupants and the motorcycle cops, Bobby Hart just on the left and B.J. Martin. And to the limo's left, a row of people, of spectators, and Ralph Sinquet has put forth the idea that there's an individual there in glasses that also looks a lot like Mr. Cruz. Now, I just wanted to mention that Cubans on the November 22nd, 1963, it's common knowledge that there were many Cubans that were holding hate signs along the parade route that day. So it's not so far-fetched to assume that it is possible that he might have been in Dallas that day. I don't know. I have no evidence to support that notion. But Ralph has identified, at least momentarily for the time being, Cruz as one of the people in the Cisco photograph. So that's bringing you up to date right now, and that is supposed to be coming out soon in the National Enquirer, and the OIC is going to be mentioned also.
All right. So what is the OIC's position on him being Rafael Cruz in Dealey Plaza at the time of the assassination?
Well, it's not actually Dealey Plaza. It's close to Dealey Plaza, but, you know, I have no position on that. I would need, you know, further corroboration on that. But anything is possible, Gary.
Tell us more about the article again in the National Enquirer.
Yeah, it already hit the supermarkets this past week. Had to do what we had already talked about in a previous show, the Wayne Madsen in the piece that showed him at the trademark down in New Orleans, downtown New Orleans, in the summer of 1963, and that we did some comparisons. And again, that was also, you know, it wasn't conclusive, you know, but it looked a lot of the features sort of lined up, and on that occasion we also stated that. So anything is possible, Gary. You know, the photograph of the man at the trademark next to Lee Oswald, and I have mentioned this many times, the photograph is not clear enough to really allow us to render a photographic comparison that is as ironclad as what we have done with the man in the doorway. Okay, you know, it's all still being researched, you know, by a lot of people.
Yeah, let's be clear that the jury is still out on this Rafael Cruz being a near Dealey Plaza and also at the trademark handing out Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets with Lee Oswald. So we're on it, but we're trying to maintain our credibility as well.
Jim's mic is muted right now.
So what do you have to feel about all this National Enquirer, Dr. Fetzer?
There you go.
There we go.
Well, I think it's fascinating, and it's one more thorn on the side of Ted Cruz. He has quite a few at this point in time. I think that Donald has all but sealed the nomination for himself, but Cruz is a very peculiar case, and there are so many questions that are related to him. We have some tremendous material here this evening, Gary. However, I'd like to proceed to give background for what Larry has to present about a very prominent member of the research community. If we look at the very first slide, you'll see the image from a movie, a film he did about the assassination, a documentary entitled JFK, The Case for Conspiracy, which was the same as the title of a book he did with Peter Modell entitled JFK, The Case for Conspiracy. And I'm talking about Robert Grodin. If we go to the next slide, you'll recognize how much good work Grodin has done, or how much apparently good work he has done, including, of course, co-authoring the book High Treason with Harry Livingston, and publishing the compilation of photographs known as The Killing of a President, with a lot of commentary, most of which is accurate, and The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, which has the best discussion of the shooting of Officer Tippit and the evidence related to that I've encountered yet. But here, as we see in the next slide, there's a number of reasons for questioning whether Grodin is completely on the up and up. To my astonishment, he denies the existence of a bullet hole in the windshield. He defends a set of autopsy photos that seem to be fabrications. He claims his Zapruder film is authentic, which actually is very odd in relation to one, because as we're going to see, there are frames in the Zapruder film that show the bullet striking the windshield. He maintains the Alchin 6 is also authentic, but denies that Oswald was in the doorway during the shooting. He offers an alternative explanation of his location at the time, which also implies that Lee cannot have been on the sixth floor, but where it's really quite fascinating that he's involved in so many of these issues, where we're going to get to the heart of the matter momentarily. If we go to the next slide, you'll see here that Grodin in The Killing of a President, it's hard to read the text, but he shows he's got an image of the Alchin 6 crop where you can see virtually in the middle of that image, a small white spiral nebula, which has a dark hole in the center where JFK's left ear would be if JFK's left ear were visible. And you see in the text where he says there's no damage to the windshield, notwithstanding the fact that we're looking right at it. If we go to the next slide, we see a comparison between the windshield as it was in the Alchin's photograph, with an arrow now to the location I was identifying as that small white spiral nebula with a dark hole in the center, where Jim Lewis has been going through junkyards in the South and firing high-powered rifles through the windshields of vehicles to see if he could hit a dummy in the back. He's not succeeded in doing so, but he's confirmed that it makes a small white spiral nebula as it passes through, and the sound of a firecracker, where we all recall that many of the witnesses reported that the first shot sounded different than the rest and resembled that of a firecracker. And then on the right, we have the spider web crack in the windshield the Secret Service would later produce. Doug Wilden, in his brilliant book, Research, published in Murder in Dealey Plaza, actually tracked down the official at Ford Motor Company that was responsible for replacing the windshield, who confirmed that it had a through-and-through hole and that the windshield they replaced it with was brand new. So what happened is the Secret Service had other windshields where Bob Livingston, World Authority on the Human Brain, had reported already in Assassination Science, 1998, that the Secret Service had obtained about 20 of these, claiming it was for target practice, but it's clear they wanted to see what it would take to penetrate the windshield to hit the president, and also to have them available to fabricate a phony replacement, as we see on right. If you go to the next, this is the report of Thomas Evan, 225, and there are frames in the Zapruder film that show the bullet hole, too. So if Grodin thinks that the film is authentic, then he shouldn't be denying that there's a hole in the windshield, because we can see its presence even in frames in the Zapruder film. Now, the next is very interesting. It's the notes that were given by Thomas Evan Robinson, who was the mortician who prepared the body for funeral. to a private investigator in May 26, 1992, where he described the gaping hole at the back of the head, the smaller wound in the right temple, the blown out crescent flap. But here, most interesting, approximately two small shrapnel wounds in the face, which were packed with wax. This is relevant to the bullet passing through the windshield because David Mantic, MD, PhD, the leading medical expert in the world on the JFK assassination, believes those were caused by tiny shards of glass that penetrated JFK's face when the bullet passed through the windshield, which I regard as a brilliant inference about how to explain it. Robinson only discovered when he was introducing embalming fluid and it was leaking out of JFK's face. Now, if you look at the next slide, you see indications not only of the difference between the wounds as they were at Parkland at the top. We had a small clean puncture wound on the top left and a small clean puncture wound with a straight line incision on the right. But after the body was brought back to Bethesda, we find that that wound to the throat had been greatly enlarged. In fact, Bob Livingston has reported receiving a phone call from Commander Humes asking him what that wound would have looked like if it had been an exit wound instead of an entry. And it appears to me that he actually used Bob's description to alter the wound to more resemble an exit wound at the bottom left. And then on the right, you see that skull flap blowout just above the ear, where I believe the ear was actually severely damaged when this fragile or exploding bullet blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium. But notice we don't see the hole in the back of the head here. It's clearly been covered up where this was an HSCA photograph. Very, very troubling. Look at the next slide and you'll see more of what I'm talking about, including at the top, two photographs that Robert Groden insists are authentic. But look at the length of the hair. These, I believe, were contrived to correspond to the idea that the bullet had entered low and entered out the top of his head. But they're clear fabrications. I mean, look at the length of the hair, even in the fake photograph at the lower left from the HSCA. The length of the hair is approximately right, but in the Groden photographs is not, where during their deposition of James Humes, the ARRB, at the suggestion of David Mantic and others, asked Commander Humes whether the patient had been given a shampoo and a haircut during the autopsy, to which he replied, no, 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 no. It's absurd, of course. But how else do you get this kind of event at the top from these fake photographs that Robert Groden has introduced and promoted? And in comparison with a fake HSCA, which at least have the hair length right. And just to see how deceptive is the HSCA, look at the next slide, which is a Harper fragment, and you'll appreciate the enormity of the Harper fragment. There's no place for that bone to have been blown out in terms of the HSCA, which is more revealing of the extent to which the HSCA was trying to redo the cover-up in a manner that would be more successful than the Warren Commission, but they blew it in so many different ways. When I asked Cyril Wecht, who'd actually been on the medical panel for the HSCA, how they accounted for, well, I'll hold off the point for one more slide. Look at the next slide, and you'll see what David Mantic discovered about the enormity of the patch that was imposed. There you have the official lateral cranial x-ray taken from the right side of the head. In the middle, you see the area that he defined as area P for patch. And you can compare that with frame 374, which I discovered by contemplating whether those who were doing the alteration of the film might have focused so much on frames related to 313 that they overlooked that you might actually be able to see it in later frames. And just notice the blowout, the pink part.
Hello?
Yeah, looks like we lost Dr. Fetzer right there. He'll probably be back in just a second.
Right. The
Larry is.
Yeah, well, this is frame, I believe, 374 that Dr. Fetzer is referring to on the right, where he found the blowout in the back of the head. Okay, there he is. Okay.
Yeah,
Gotta unmute him.
Unmute there, Doc.
Chance, we're on the wrong. Go to the next slide, please. David Lifton was the first to recognize that there was an enormous difference between the description of the blowout on the head and the autopsy report, where he reconstructed this massive blowout. Look, it's about half of the back of the head is missing versus the fist-sized wound seen at Parkland reported by Clint Hill and others versus, of course, the absurdity on the right, which is the HSCA. So that when I called Cyril Wecht, who'd been on the HSCA medical panel, and asked Cyril, I said, how did the HSCA account for the enormous discrepancy between the description of this massive blowout scene in the autopsy report, which is described in mathematical detail, and the single hole they introduced at the top of the head, which was even 4 inches higher than the wound at the back of the head the Bethesda physicians had properly identified? He said to me, I'll have to check my notes. In the next slide, you'll see a comparison of what we have discovered in frame 374 and earlier frames where the blowout was painted over in black. I mean, look on the right where you have that huge blowout, the skull flap and all that, with on the left where it's been painted out in black. And we all know that a professional film, Hollywood film restoration experts have been studying the forensic copy of the film. I've been in their studio. I've seen the version. It's remarkably clear and precise. And we're astonished at the amateurishness of the manner in which the blowout had been painted over. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see what Larry Rivera had discovered in an even earlier frame, where Jackie's hand and her white glove just happened to be in the right position to illustrate the extent of the massive blowout. And where we have several slides in a row, Gary, would you like to comment on them?
Yeah, this was, we've done a few shows and discussed this before, but since it falls into place with what we're talking about, where Grodin was, in fact, I believe Grodin was the first researcher to get his hands on those autopsy photographs that show that clean back of the head with a little small hole in it, which obviously have been doctored, where, you know, matte inserts have been used to create the impression that the back of the head is intact. Now, when you compare those images, those photographs, with what we see here in frame 343, which I obtained from a very clear copy of the Zapruder film that I found in a documentary. And you can see it's very obvious that the jagged edge here of the blowout in the back of the head, and the next slide is going to illustrate it even further, because what we have done in the next slide is actually trace, you know, where the skull should have been and how the glove of Jackie provides the perfect background to for the viewer to appreciate the massive amount of damage to JFK's skull there in the occipital parietal area. And I also wanted to mention, and back up a little bit from when you were discussing David Mantic, that he has published this marvelous book on the Harper fragment, where he has conclusively proven that it is occipital parietal bone. Okay, and that is irrefutable. Is the research in his book has been accepted by all the peers, peer reviewed by everybody in the JFK community, and they all agree that the Harper fragment came from that area of the skull. This next slide also illustrates in a different manner how we can see that area of the rear of the head, which has been completely blasted out, Jim.
Larry, why don't you continue with the series of slides that follow to demonstrate the new revelations we have about Robert Grodin, especially that emanate from his book with Peter Modell, published in 1976, JFK, The Case for Conspiracy.
Yeah, well, this past weekend, I believe you received an email from an individual who pointed out how Grodin had published in this book in 1976 regarding who the man in the doorway was at that time. Peter Modell was a writer from New York, and he teamed up with Grodin at the time. And this was a little before Grodin was hired as a photographic consultant for the HSCA. All right.
Okay.
And apparently,
Larry, we've been asked to identify who Robert Groden is. He is one of the most prominent public figures in the JFK assassination research community. He and Josiah Thompson were early champions of the conspiracy movement, or at least were so regarded. We have in past programs demonstrated that Josiah Thompson actually was leading us down the wrong path and has repudiated his best work, the double hit theory, in order to prepare to denounce conspiracy for the 50th. But because I'd already talked about his planning to do just that, they abandoned the project. And now we're going into Robert Groden, who, by the way, among other things, was a first to get a bootleg copy of the Zapruder film on television in 1975 when he and Dick Gregory appeared with Geraldo on his show. It was broadcast for the first time. In fact, it was the public seeing the film in the violent back and to the left motion, indicative of a shot fired from the right front, that led to the creation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations and the reinvestigation. So Groden has played a pivotal role there and in other regards.
Yes, well, I'll go a little bit further back, Jim. Groden was 18 years old on November 22nd. That was his birthday. It happened to be his birthday, November 22nd, 1963. And he had been napping that day, and as the book explains, and his mother woke him up and told him about the assassination. And ever since that moment, he had been supposedly hooked on the assassination and the aftermath. And at a very early age, in his early 20s, he began to cozy up to a lot of the researchers at the time. And in 1969, he met Harold Weisberg and became very, very good friends with Mr. Weisberg, to the point where he used to spend weekends at Weisberg's house over in Maryland. And so, he helped Weisberg out in many ways, providing blow-ups and enhancements of the Zapruder film. And like I mentioned earlier, apparently he was the very first researcher to get his hands on the autopsy photographs, which show the back of the head intact. Okay, then later on he published talking about with Mondale in 1976. Mm-hmm. And apparently, this book, despite having a lot of really good information, was not that good a seller. And in the summer of 1966, it seems like Mr. Groden might have been out of a job, thereafter, he was hired as a photographic consultant through the House Select Committee on Assassination.
Yeah, you can't emphasize that enough, that Groden was actually hired by the House Select Committee for the specific purpose of determining the identity of the man in the doorway. Continue, Larry, with advance the slides.
Yeah, and this is one of the major contributions to the man in the doorway issue, this very clear blow-up of the people that were in the doorway, where we have proven, I believe, with our overlay technology and computer enhancements, that the man in the doorway is actually Lee Harvey Oswald.
We have proven it, but not only beyond a reasonable doubt, meaning no alternative hypothesis is reasonable, but I would submit beyond any doubt. The evidence, the mass, the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, the T-shirt, but your brilliant work by introducing Lee Harvey Oswald's face and that of Billy Lovelady into the image of Doorman, I think, has sealed the deal.
Yeah, well, and we have taken that research even further by using other images of Billy Lovelady, where we have excluding Lee Oswald as a possibility. We have excluded beyond any doubt that Billy Lovelady would possess the features that are seen on Doorman. When we set the interpupillary distance and scale the faces accordingly, then it's pretty obvious and it's very conclusive.
Yeah. Oh, go for it, Larry. Go on to Groden.
Yeah, and then the next slide is an article that we found back from 1976 in the Orlando Sentinel, where it very clearly says here that Robert Groden and Peter Modell, when they published their book, that it was Lee Harvey Oswald standing there in the
doorway. Let me read the first two paragraphs. Was Lee Harvey Oswald standing quietly in a doorway of the Texas School Book Depository at the time? Official records say he was killing President John F. Kennedy with a rifle shot fired from a sixth-floor window. The answer is yes, according to Robert J. Groden, the Ernest Young author with F. Peter Modell of the new paperback, JFK, The Case for Conspiracy, which I have been showing here, The Case for Conspiracy, Groden and Modell. Go on.
That's right. And the next slide is the actual reference to that book of page 148, I believe. Yeah, page 148 and 149, where the authors discuss the man in the doorway. Now, a lot of the information that Groden obtained obviously came from Harold Weisberg, because we have discussed this many times. Whitewash 2 was the volume where Weisberg came out with the 9-point comparison of the shirts, because a very important point here about the shirts, because we're going to show something very, very disturbing to Harold Weisberg, that when Groden published that famous book, Killing of a President. Okay. Now the next slide is also from
Let me read a couple of passages from this page.
Back up here a little bit.
While it is true that Oswald and Lovelady shared many similar facial features, leading to the confusion, the shirt discrepancies are too great. Other amateur films made that day in color show two men resembling each other facially, but only facially, where Lovelady was wearing a broad red and blue, actually it was red and white, plaid. Well, here they're talking about a broad red and blue plaid shirt, but actually we know, Larry, that it was the red and white vertically striped short sleeve shirt. When arrested, Oswald wore a T-shirt with a broken elastic collar. Actually, it was stretched. And the same orange tweed shirt with missing buttons, accounting for the open front in the Alchin's photo. While the cheeks, noses, hairlines, and eyes of the two could, in truth, belong to either one, Oswald was clean-shaven. The other, Lovelady, had a growth of beard. This is evident from seeing three other amateur films, two in color, one in black and white. Crucial as this identification is to the heart of the case, observes researcher Held Weisberg, in all 10 million words, the Warren Report does not print any of these photographs. No wonder, had it done so, the verdict would never have stood up. Lee Harvey Oswald could not have stood in the doorway on the first floor while he was on the sixth floor killing the president with a rifle. As Weisberg puts it, pictures may not lie, but they can be made to lie by ignoring them.
That's right. That's right.
And, of course, the fact is we know that pictures can lie because they altered frames of the Zapruder film, for example. Even that claim is correct, but Weisberg was unaware of the technology at the time.
Well, they altered the frames from the Zapruder film, and they removed frames because we have noticed the speed glitches and the blink rates with Roy, mentioning Roy Schaefer's tremendous research on that. And so it's kind of, you know, the question
is... Yes, go to 20, Chance. Go to 20. Yes.
Yeah.
Because the caption there, actually, I can read it.
The blow-up of the man in the doorway shows him wearing the same tweed pattern overshirt and the same T-shirt.
That's right. The caption on the lower photograph. This blow-up of the man in the doorway shows him wearing the same tweed pattern overshirt, the same T-shirt with worn elastic that Oswald wore at the time of his arrest.
Right.
Exactly, Larry.
Right. Next slide, please.
21.
This is page 186 of Killing of a President, and this is where Groden does a 180 degree turnaround here, where he actually talks about.
Larry, are you there? Did we lose him?
I'm here.
Well, Groden does a 180 degree turn and denies that the man in the doorway is Lee Oswald, affirms it was Billy Lovelady, which is fairly shocking in and of itself.
That's right. Now, can you hear me?
Oh. Yeah, we can. We can.
Okay, now, see, the top right, and this is what was very disturbing in the eyes of Harold Weisberg. If you look at the shirt at the top right, the way that it's been arranged, as you can see, the shirt itself has the collar all tied up together, okay? And it's obvious that the top two buttons are missing. The top three buttons are missing. And this is the exact shirt that Lee Oswald was wearing. And in Harold Weisberg's book where he criticizes Grodin, this is one of his main points of criticism, where he was saying that when Grodin published this page of his book, he was making the shirt look more like the man in the doorway in the Martin film. Okay, with the inference being that this was the same shirt. And obviously, Weisberg called him out on that, type of deception and, said, wait a minute, that's Lee Oswald's shirt and that's not the way that he was wearing it. Okay, he was wearing it completely splayed open. It was a worn shirt. Okay, and that's not the way it was arranged. Okay, so he right away he pointed out the deception here that apparently was being played out here on page 186 of this book. Okay, I can't hear Jim. Okay, now this is page 187, and we have discussed this before regarding the shirt of the man, which we call Gorilla Man, and the shirt that he was wearing, and with the obvious pocket flap in the pocket on the left breast, which is absent in the other photographs of Billy Lovelady, and that plaid shirt, checkered colored shirt that he was wearing when Grodin went to photograph him in Denver in 1976, and the other photograph at the top where I believe it was Jackson that took that picture of him standing there in the doorway, where neither of those shirts exhibit the pocket and the flap there on the left breast.
Yeah, but of course the actual shirt that Billy Lovelady was wearing is shown in the middle. It's this vertically striped red and white shirt.
That's right. That's
sleeve, which means it's a non-starter to even think that Billy was doorman because he was wearing a short sleeve shirt with red and white vertical stripes. So Grodin has been the primary force behind perpetrating the fraud on the American people that doorman was wearing a red and black checkered shirt. I mean, it's an outrage, Larry. When you get right down to it, it's disgusting.
Well, we zoom in on that issue right now on the next slide where we show close-ups of the individual in the Martin film. And it's pretty obvious here where that is a pocket and a flap with a little button, okay? And it seems like there might even be something in there, maybe a pack of cigarettes in there. And when you compare to the three photographs at the top, which are the ones that Grodin took of Lovelady in Denver in 1976, which were later published in the House Select Committee addendums, which, by the way, were not released until the early 90s after the House the ARRB came into play.
Bear in mind that Grodin is supposed to be a photographic expert. He couldn't possibly miss the difference that there's a pocket on the shirt of the man they're posing to be Billy Lovelady, who in fact is a third person altogether to whom we refer to as Gorilla Man. Even if you look at his profile there with a photo at the top most leftmost in the center, you can see they have completely different profiles. This is one of the greatest disgraces in the history of JFK research, in my opinion, Larry.
Well, as Professor John Johnson wrote in one of his marvelous articles in the Fourth Decade, this would be the evidence of a massive hoax perpetrated on the American public.
Okay. By Robert Grodin.
Yeah.
Keep in mind that Robert Grodin to this day, so if he switched over in 76, we're talking 40 years of
deceit and deception. 40 years of deceit and deception.
Now, if you were in Dallas just the very last year, or at the New Orleans conference, his job was to talk about the Z film being authentic and Billy Lovelady being in the doorway. That is his job. And if I'm counting right, it's about 40 years on. Or he didn't make a pretty good paycheck on doing that one.
It's right here. We're going to get to that briefly here. Okay, the next slide shows us this sort of like a chronological guide here where Harold Weisberg was talking about the dire straits that Grodin was going through in the summer of 1976 before he was hired by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And the next slide is a document that was not was not released until the early 90s. And this is a smoking gun as far as I'm concerned, Jim, because this is a statement, okay, that was taken by Kenneth Bruton, who was assistant counsel for Richard Sprague, the first counsel for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, who was later fired because he insisted on getting all the information out from the CIA and the FBI without any type of intermediaries or buffers or anybody who would prevent him from getting, you know, all the documents that he wanted for his investigation. And he got fired because of that. Okay. Now, this document, which we submitted to a handwriting expert who is certified, who has done a lot of work in criminal investigations and who has presented her expertise in courts and in cases in civil and criminal cases, and this is a comparison of the signatures of Lovelady. Now, what this statement is saying is that a man standing in the entrance of the doorway with the plaided sick shirt on is Billy and Lovelady, and is signed by Billy Lovelady. As a witness, we have Patricia Lovelady with Billy's wife. And she says, "I hereby identify this to be my husband, Billy Nolan Lovelady." Okay. And at the bottom, it's supposedly witnessed by Robert Groden on 11/13/1976, and Kenneth Bruton at the top. Okay. Now, Kenneth Bruton, being a lawyer and being a professional, I would presume, for them to have brought out this type of document, in my mind, is pretty pathetic. Okay, now any lawyer would have known that an affidavit should have been drawn up with an impartial notary public bearing witness to this, and having the seal stamped on the document. Okay, now this is a very informal, weird, for lack of a better word, document where they're trying to confirm that it's Billy Lovelady. And what we did is that I see that it supposedly is signed by Billy Lovelady, and we went and we dug up his signatures from bona fide affidavits that we knew belonged to Billy Lovelady from November 22nd, 1963, the weekend of the assassination. And we said, well, you know, let's know what a professional would think about this, okay? And we see both of the signatures here, and they don't look alike at all, okay? But we submitted them to somebody who didn't even know who Billy Lovelady was. Okay, and the next slide.
And what it turned out was that Groden had faked the signature of Billy Lovelady, Larry. You can't drive that home hard enough.
Well, apparently, and this is the opinion of Kim Johnson. She's a CMHA, okay? And you want to just read this through for us, Jim? I mean, this is running here.
The opinion of a professional. Recently, a thorough handwriting analysis of this document was performed by certified handwriting expert Kim Johnson, CMHA. This is the result of her study. Clearly, the two signature exemplars look little alike. One is bigger than the other. One uses a middle name. The other does not. In addition, there are numerous variances in letter formation accompanied by major differences in at least seven separate graphology areas. Furthermore, other than diacritical heights, upper zone widths, and capital letter widths, there are no modes or measurements alike. However, I did not anticipate that diacriticals, upper zone, and capitals would fall within the same mode. This gives me a lot of pause. Kindly remember that such measurements are mostly subconsciously driven and automatic. Some flagrant stroke or letter formation differences are briefly listed here. Exemplar 1, angular upper zone formations. Exemplar 2, upper zone formations are rounded. Exemplar 1, the capital B in Billy is embellished. Exemplar 2 is not. Exemplar 1, final signature stroke varies completely from exemplar number 2. Exemplar number 2, middle initial N, much smaller than rest of signature. Exemplar 1 is not. Exemplar 2 has a broader D loop in Lovelady than number 1. Exemplar 2 has decided directional pressure. Why in Love Lady number 1 does not? Exemplar 2 has decided varying heights of the two eyes in Billy, while 1 does not. This is, however, not conclusive. More handwriting samples desired. Exemplar 2 has broader E-loop than Exemplar 1. However, this particular trait is not fixed. Exemplar number 1 has a left-leaning final stroke, L in Love Lady. Number 2 does not. Evidence of slow writing. Exemplar number 1 stabs his ovals. Number 2 uses garlands. Exemplar number 2 has a fishhook on his capital L, Love Lady. It is absent in number 1. Emphasis hours. Exemplar number 1 uses retracing strokes on Billy, indicating much tension. Number 2 does not. Exemplar 2 has eliminated the final Y in Love Lady. In 1, it is evident.
In red, important postscript, the handwritten note dated 11/22/1976, which begins, "The man standing in the entrance contains a lie." In other words, the writer is lying when he identifies the man as Billy and Love Lady.
Yeah. So, can I translate here? We have a forged document by Robert Grodin. It's what we have.
I don't think it gets any more specific than this, Jim. Okay.
Yeah. Now,
let's move on to the next slide quickly here.
27.
Yeah, 27. Okay. Now, this is a portion of a letter from Weisberg where he is sort of like wondering where was Robert Grodin that weekend. Okay, and Grodin apparently was very evasive, you know, in telling him and letting him know, you know, where he was, you know, and he says that he had been on a short trip. Okay. And Weisberg is questioning, you know, the ellipsis, in other words, you know, his sudden disappearances, you know, when he could find him and that kind of thing, you know, and he assumed that what Grodin was doing, at that time was dealing with the Oswald Love Lady shirt issue, okay? And so that's sort of like leads us on to the next slide here.
Well, Larry, let me offer a conjecture. He was being solicited by the HSCA, by some of its staff, to become a special consultant on the condition that he would reverse the position he adopted in the book with Model.
That's a very good assumption, Jim. That's why I'm presenting, you know, these facts. You know, I'm being as factual and analytical as possible here. But the information being provided here is pretty obvious here. And over the years, Grodin and Weisberg had a very serious falling out, which led him to actually write a book on what Grodin represented as far as Weisberg was concerned. We can go on to the next slide, please. In the JFK community and the assassination industry, what he called. Okay, and this is a copyright in 1996. And if you read this document, it's pretty stunning in the way Weisberg really tears Grodin apart, you know, from beginning all the way to the end. One of the main issues that Weisberg was concerned is that when the film JFK was being filmed and produced by Oliver Stone, where he brought on Grodin as a photographic consultant and also actually helping him do all the filming at Dealey Plaza and where everybody was and where, you know, the motorcycle and the limos and everything. And there was a copy of the script that was leaked, okay, to the press. And the copy of the script was used by the mainstream media to attack Oliver Stone in a way that had never been ever done by anybody filming a movie, especially one that is controversial as this one.
And Larry, did we lose you again? They really don't want this out tonight, Chance. It's unbelievable how many times we've been disrupted. Just unbelievable.
Larry's doing good.
We need.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah, I think we're dropping in and out on your end.
Yeah, so basically what happened was that Weisberg was accused of being the one because he was provided with a copy of the script. And by inference, a lot of the researchers assumed that it had been Weisberg, the one who had leaked Oliver Stone's script. Okay, and so this coupled with you know, a lot of the other issues that Weisberg thought that Grodin wasn't being honest about, specifically, you know, plagiarism, disinformation, which he talks about in this book here, and the title of the book is obviously Picturing the Corruption of the JFK Assassination, and he goes through a lot of the different issues that he had with Grodin and the discrepancies and what he thought that Grodin misrepresented in the JFK assassination industry. And one of those was had to do with the man in the doorway. And this next slide is a study that we did of Billy Lovelady and Gorilla Man, who was the man in the Martin film. And what we did was find the two best images that showed him in profile and compared him to the profile of Billy Lovelady that was taken at the by the FBI on February the 29th, 1964. And we just lined up the features. And at the bottom, when we lined up the ears, okay, the top of the head did not line up. When we lined up the top of the cranium, you know, the chin and the nose did not line up, or the ear, and so on and so forth. The chins, when we lined those up, and you can see how dissimilar they are when you compare, for example, the angle of the neck. Okay, Lovelady, the angle of his neck was sort of straight down. The man that we show as Gorilla Man was at an angle. Okay, the hairline. Once we started working with these, you know, we found a great deal of difference between one and the other. The occipital protuberances were not the same. The ear angle in Lovelady was more vertical. The bald spot was different.
And yet, Grodin, the HSCA council never noticed these discrepancies. Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, and if you look closely at the top left image, you'll notice that the plaid shirt is buttoned up at to the neck. And this goes back to what we were discussing earlier on page 186 of his book. Okay, this is the reason why Weisberg said that the deception that was involved in Grodin's book on page 186, where he presented that Oswald's shirt completely shut at the top, okay, and that's what his point was.
Sure.
Being that what they were trying to do was make him look like Gorilla Man in the Martin film. Okay, so
no, he didn't fool Weisberg. Let's go to your next slide, Larry.
Yes. Okay, and this is an excerpt that we have here on from Weisberg's book that just shows, you know, by and large, you know, a lot of the issues that he had with Grodin, you know, and what I was just talking about, where the Lovelady shirt was buttoned to the top, okay, to the top of the collar, and that's not the way that the man in the doorway's shirt was, okay, and just by that issue alone, Weisberg was able to completely refute Grodin's research, okay, or what Grodin was trying to present, okay. Now. We want to finish this presentation with something that's really important here. It's going to blow everybody's mind. It's stuff that's already known, okay? The next slide. Grodin was brought in.
Larry, you got to move forward. We only have about 7 minutes.
Yeah, that's what I was just, yeah. This was, Grodin was brought in to the O.J. Simpson civil trial when the Goldmans sued him for damages regarding the...
Just for the audience, remember, O.J. was accused of murdering not only Nicole Simpson, but Ron Goldman, who was a young man who'd come to her house ostensibly to return a pair of glasses she'd left behind at the Messaluna restaurant, though they may, in fact, have had a relationship. As far as the story goes, he was just there innocently returning the glasses when he was slashed to death by the perp.
That's right. And he was found innocent in the criminal case. And this goes back to the unrest and the...
Which had to do with the gloves that didn't fit, where they contrived the situation by having OJ put on latex gloves over what would have been skin-tight fitting leather gloves to create the impression they didn't fit. And then Johnny Carquin argued, if the gloves don't fit, you must acquit.
That's right. That's right. But the point in time of that trial was very important because what had happened previously, a couple of years before with Rodney King, with the beating that he received, sort of prejudiced this jury to, especially being, you know, from inner city Los Angeles, you know, and not being an all-white jury, where they found him innocent despite all of the incredible evidence that was presented against O.J. Simpson. But a couple of years later, when the civil trial came, where only 75% of the jury needed to be in accordance in order to render a verdict, they brought in Grodin. And Grodin was brought in as a supposed photographic expert to talk about the Bruno Magli shoes that were shown in a photograph of O.J. Simpson at a Buffalo Bills game a few years
ago. Explain why they were important, Larry.
Yeah, the reason they were important is because the prints of those shoes were found at the scene of the crime. Okay, and it was very 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 specific that it was those shoes that those shoes had been identified as the shoes that belonged to the perpetrator of the assassination of Nicole and Ron Goldman, and so that was already established that those shoes were. Belong to the man who killed these two individuals. Now, when the civil trial came up, you know, and they found OJ wearing those shoes at a Buffalo Bills game where he was brought out as one of the heroes, you know, one of the players who had played for the Buffalo Bills and had ran for 2,000 yards 1 year, you know, whatever, and was a hero in Buffalo. And so, lo and behold, he was wearing Bruno Magli shoes.
So okay, they needed Robert Grodin to debunk the evidence that O.J. actually had this pair of shoes.
That's right. And what Grodin came out was in under oath, I might add, that photograph had been doctored, that photograph had been messed around with, and that it wasn't real. It was a fabrication. Okay.
And then it turned out that.
So then, what happened was that this photograph had been published in the Globe, one of these tabloids, supermarket tabloids, and they went in and they found the photographer, and the photographer had about 30 other photographs of the same event that showed other photographs. In fact, even better photographs that they were able
to. Of O.J. wearing the very same shoes, so Grodin had given false testimony under oath.
That's right. That's right.
Let's go to your next slide, Larry. I want to make sure we polish them up.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next slide is Weisberg talking about exactly the effect that Grodin's appearance in this trial had, where as soon as he gave his misrepresentation there at that trial, the case against Simpson was cinched completely, and the plaintiffs completely abandoned.
Because they could bring out all these other photographs that proved O.J. had the shoes, which he denied even owning.
That's right, and Weisberg minces no words, you know, where he says that Grodin, for example, and I'll just read this, you know, had what Grodin, where they brought other professionals who with the proper credentials, and who had what Grodin did not have, the proper education, the training, the professional experience. In effect, Grodin made those shoes the central part of the case. The plaintiffs ended the case immediately after the effective rebuttals they were able to present to the jury. That left those shoes in the front of the minds of these jurors, the last thing Simpson's lawyers wanted, and what the lawyer for the plaintiffs might well have preferred. That was the end of the case. So
Grodin made a contribution, ironically, in helping prove that O.J. had committed the crime. Go to the last two slides, Larry, we have to wrap it up.
And these are slides that we have presented before. The man in the doorway, the comparison with Billy Lovelady, our photogrammetric comparisons, which show conclusively that the man in the doorway is, in fact, Lee Oswald and not Billy Lovelady. And this is the first slide is with one of the pictures, the one that we inverted, okay, that we were criticized so much for. But the last slide is the one from the Love Lady image from the Tom Jackson photo shoot, which shows the non-inverted version of Love Lady. If you look closely on the right, the ear doesn't even reach far enough to match the ear of Doorman, and the nose is completely disjointed. The lips are out of place. You know, I mean,
Larry, brilliant job, Gary. You want to take us home?
Yeah, I'd like to give a little credit if it is due. Was there a specific person who brought up the 1976 Robert Groden book?
Oh yeah, well Jim has that information.
Yeah, I'd have to check my email, Gary. Just take us out.
All right. We'll make sure to get credit for that next time. All right. This has been the JFK Show number 100. Chance George, Dr. Fetzer, Larry Rivera, and myself. We'll see you next week for show 101.
Hi, this is Gary King. Here's a song written when I was just 18. People have always enjoyed this song, and finally, 40 years later, I went ahead and recorded it. If you like it, download it on iTunes. It's called I'm Not in Love, I'm Just in Heat. Gary King. Go to iTunes and download it if you like it.
Bring my honey, but you sure are sweet.
All right, a song for 40 years played at party after party after party in the city of partying, New Orleans, Louisiana. If you dig it, go to iTunes and download it. I'm not in love, I'm just in heat, Gary King. And I also hope you enjoy the programming we provide here. And if you're into JFK, you can go to my YouTube channel, Gary King YouTube. And I do a weekly show with Jim Fetzer, Don Fox, and Larry Rivera. Hope to see you soon.